Welcome to the New Schools Podcast. Today's guest, Clark Aldrich, has been called a guru by Fortune magazine and a maverick by CNN. His work in educational media has been featured by the New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, CBS, ABC, NPR, ESPN, CNET, and US News and World Report. We first discovered his work through his 2011 book, Unschooling Rules, 55 Ways to Unlearn What We Know About Schools and Rediscover Education. Some of the points he makes in that book include tests don't work, that what a person learns in a classroom is how to be a person in a classroom, and that animals are better than books about animals. More recently, Clark created the revolutionary pedagogy known as Short Sims. Short Sims are educational simulations that you can go play around with right now at shortsims.com. They've been custom developed for a variety of organizations such as Visa, the Department of State, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Center for Army Leadership. Clark continues to work with leading organizations, both public and private. He held top secret clearance for his strategic work with the U.S. military, was the founder and former director of research for Gartner's e-learning coverage, and has also worked with Education Testing Service, Harvard Business Publishing, and the National Security Agency. He now trains designers based on his most recent book, Short Sims, A Game Changer. Today's show covers the lack of learner control in traditional schools, the linear-driven media and its prevalence in schools, how we can create content that gets learners active in teaching themselves, and Clark's conversations with Jeff Sandifer about rethinking schools. Sandifer, of course, is the founder of Acton Academy, and we'll get him on the show one of these days. In the meantime, enjoy this conversation with your host, Shannon Falkenstein, and Clark Aldrich.
Hello, Clark Aldrich, and welcome to the New Schools Podcast. Thank you so much for having this discussion with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. So I first heard about you when I read your book, Unschooling Rules, in about 2015, when I was preparing to start my own Acton Academy. So first, I want to say thank you and recommend your book to all of our audience.
I guarantee it's a fast read. No matter if you like it or if you hate it, you'll get through it very quickly. So,
yes, it is. It's a super easy read, which I really appreciated. And because it's like 55 small chunks that you can digest really easily. We've used this as fodder for parent discussions and student discussions where we just listed them, cut them out, put them in a hat and pulled them out and talked about them. And it was just a really easy and fun way to digest some very revolutionary concepts when you're, you know, inviting people who are almost everyone is used to conventional school and then bringing them to a new paradigm. This was a very digestible way of doing it. So I think you-
The book
you
I wrote before this it. Was about 600 pages long and it weighed quite a few pounds. And it was an industry book on simulation design. And so it's really, really fun to write something that's a lot lighter, easier to carry in the briefcase, to be sure. But also it is a really interesting challenge of saying how much can you kind of distill to the essence of something. I think that's gonna be something obviously perhaps we'll talk about it a bit later on, but it seems like in this day and age when people are less excited to read, frankly, and people are more, you know, more interested into experiences, I think a challenge of anyone who's producing content is like saying, how much can we distill something to the absolute, almost Socratic essence? How can we create the two sentences that when someone hears it, they think about it and almost come to their own conclusions? And how much can we create content that's not the boss, that's not directive, that's not lecturing at them, but engaging them and saying, here's some thoughts, go with it, you know, and see how far you can take it. I'm not giving you all the answers because there are no answers, but, you know, here's a place to start.
I love it. So I listened to another podcast interview with you and you talked about kind of a moment in time where the idea for this book was born, and that it was actually in a conversation with Jeff Sandifer prior to his launching Acton Academy. Can you tell us a little more about that moment?
Yeah, so Jeff and I have had a lot of conversation about education. We get together and we talk about SATs and we talk about, you know, colleges, and we talk about, you know, which colleges are worth it and what's the right model for colleges. And obviously his big obsession in terms of how do we rethink what schools need to be, you know, moving forward. So these are the conversations. So he obviously did his Acton MBA program prior to Acton Academy. And we were talking about education in general, and he was literally saying, you know, I'm thinking of starting this Acton school, this Acton Academy, or I'm thinking about it. And he said, but, you know, one reason is because, you know, if we don't do this, we're going to unschool. If we don't do this, we're going to homeschool. If, you know, we cannot find a school that we think will do more good than harm. And sort of at that moment, exactly when he said that, I was like, oh, wait, this would be an interesting thing to think about. And in my own experience as well, as I've worked on a lot of school boards, I've worked with a lot of institutions, and the spectacular failure of school, I think, is epic. And I was at a point where saying any single good idea schools can ruin. You can have the best idea in the world and saying, hey, you know, it's important for people to be motivated. And schools will say, great, let's motivate kids. And then they'll fail and say, oh, it's really important for kids to have good self-esteem. Great. Well, we'll have self-esteem classes. And then that fails. And oh, good, it's really important that we teach leadership. And so it was, you know, literally every single great idea you sort of throw against the school, they would just destroy.
Why do you think that's so?
That's the whole point of unschooling rules. The whole point of unschooling rules is saying it's not one thing; it's a whole lot of things. It's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of good people. I don't think there's any villains in this story. There's a lot of good people who all are trying to do the right thing and collectively spectacularly failing. And you know, it's easy to see doom loops in other industries. It's easy to see doom loops in plenty of corporations, you know, crash and burn, not because the people are bad, but because, you know, they get in their own personal doom loops and they have reinforcing cycles that hurt. So you almost have to go through it. I mean, it's almost so immense talking about schools, and it can sort of suck you up so quickly, which is why I kind of like thinking, rather than saying almost what's wrong with school, it's like taking a specific thing and saying, okay, let's think about leadership. Why are schools so bad at leadership? You know, why can't a school teach leadership? Or an easier one, project management. You know, why can't a school teach project management? And if you sort of just take it from one perspective, here's a skill everyone talks about, everyone thinks is a valuable skill. We all want people to know how to manage projects, whether it's a personal one or a professional one or an after school project. You know, we all want people to be good at project management. There's, you know, a fairly good skill set out there. It's not like this mysterious thing, perhaps like leadership, which is a lot more nebulous. So why can't schools do it? Why is this notion that gets the one of the first unschooling rules, which is there is a fundamental difference between how to teach someone to know something or how to learn to know versus learn to do. And schools have been really, really proficient at learning to know and spectacularly bad at learning to do. And that's, you know, and to me, that's just really interesting. So it's all these failure points that, again, made unschooling rules interesting, and also I think has shaped my own research and projects to try to figure out how to get around it.
So do you think, though, that there's a fundamental, I think that schools fundamentally don't trust kids, and that a lot of the root of why they ruin everything is because they over-control children and the learners instead of allowing them and trusting them to go with things. Would you agree with that statement?
Sure, I'll say it two different ways, or I'll build on the point, I think. And one of them is, if you have to get kids to do things, if you have to get kids to do, you know, you have to, no matter what, at the end of the day, you have to get kids to do something. You can't force people to be creative. You can't force people to be imaginative. You can't force people to take ownership for a problem. What you can force them to do is move a little block from here to here. You can force them to outline a butterfly. You can force them to do 16 math problems using this formula. And so I think, you know, we've evolved schools to be constantly, what can we force kids to do? And what can we force them to do in little tiny little bits? So how can we break up curriculum into little tiny bits that we can force kids to do and then force them to do it? So it's a natural reaction to the pressures of schools. It's a natural reaction to sort of this institutional model that we have. It's not really a matter of not trusting them, even though they don't trust them, but there's no predictability. They need predictability, and kids are nothing but predictable. They need to be efficient, and learning is not efficient at all. So I think there's it's not because they wake up in the morning and go, oh, those rotten kids. By the way, what they do wake up in the morning and say, oh, those rotten parents.
Yeah.
So I think it's what's spectacularly predictable is anytime, and again, I'm an outsider in most communities I'm in. So I sort of have the outsider perspective. And I spend time, you know, with school boards, and I spend time with again, SAT companies and stuff and all these other kind of places. And invariably, when you have five teachers talking, within about 10 minutes, they're going to be criticizing parents. And that is just part of their program. Oh, this parent was, you know, this child's, you know, had the worst parents ever. Let me tell you about these. Oh, these parents. So yeah, I think they deal with the reality of kids and the reality of their goal, which is not to make them great people, but to get them, you know, push them through the curriculum. But they really, really don't like the parents. And I think that's been a really toxic part of the whole school process. They view parents as the enemies, and they love passing back and forth stories of failures in parenting that I think is just really toxic. I think it has created a really negative environment.
Yeah, and I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg. I think also parents are hostile towards schools and teachers. Jessica Leahy has, in her book, The Gift of Failure, she outlines wonderful, clear, actionable steps that parents can take to make that relationship a lot better with their school, which I found to be extremely helpful and resonated at being a school leader.
When I drafted Unschooling Rules, I shared it with a bunch of friends, including some principals and superintendents that I knew, and expecting them to hate it. And they actually ended up really, really liking it. And that was always, there's a few lines in it that they really had problems with, and actually took out those lines because they were applause lines for people who hate schools, which was not fair for me to include. But by and large, they actually found it a very useful, you know, meaningful experience. And they actually did share it with parents as well to try to sort of break down the barrier of this sort of, you know, relationship between schools and parents and schools. And it is, again, it's just tragic that this is sort of what we're at. But I think, fundamentally schools are not built to do what we want them to do. And I have a very specific, and I wrote Unschooling Rules with this in mind, but I never said it explicitly. And part of my theory is anyone who reads Unschooling Rules will come to this conclusion on their own. But I'm going to ruin the whole experience of coming to it on your own by being explicit about it here, which is the underlying message of Unschooling Rules is there's really one point to school. The one point for school is saying every single person, every single student, every single kid they're really good at some things and they're pretty bad at other things. But there's some things that they're really good at. There's some things they're actually best in the world at. Some things they're spectacularly good at. Most people I've ever met are best in the world at least something. They also have their unique passions and things they care about. They really care about animals. They really care about the environment. They really care about free markets, whatever. They really want to lead a good life, whatever. They care about certain things passionately. They have certain skills that they can do better than anything else. The only goal of school is to connect these two things. The only goal of school is saying, how can I take this thing that I'm better at than anyone else, this mission I care about more than anyone else, and how do I connect them? And how do I connect them through honing? How do I connect them through internships? How do I connect them through getting them on the right job, to creating the right job in some cases? I mean, my job didn't exist when I was in school. It's all stuff that I had to create along the way. So I think that's the point of school, and everything else that's not that is a distraction, is a waste, for someone learning some science, non-Euclidean math or reading Dostoevsky or whatever is sort of the most important thing ever and gets them along this journey. For 90% of everyone else, it's totally a waste of time. Or maybe kind of good thing, like eating candy or something. It might be fascinating, but not helpful. And so schools haven't dealt with that. And by the way, did you come to that conclusion when reading Unschooling Rules? Did that like just percolate up in you and sort of saying, yeah, okay, that makes sense?
You know, no, I don't want to say that. It was part of a whole complex of thought also around learn to be, learn to do, and learn to learn. And that, and the whole idea with Acton of finding your passion, and that takes an exploration, right? And then, so giving all kinds of, you know, exposure to different, like you said, you know, animals and environment and gardening and robotics and whatever, until the child's like, this is what I really want to do. And then empowering them. Uh-huh. So yeah, definitely. I mean, that's like the raison d'etre of Acton and why we're here. So I absolutely agree with your ideal goal for school. But I know that there's, you know, as soon as you say that, a lot of conventional folks will say, but wait a minute, what about, you know, this whole core content that everyone needs to know, and they need to know this, you know, core content that so that we all have a shared understanding, or what about getting into a great college? You know, these are the things that parents, I think about, and conventional educators. Can you kind of allay their fears a little bit?
Well, I think there are some core things that everyone should know. I think there is some degree of reading, some degree of writing, some degree of math, some degree, you know, of general cultural literacy that I, not cultural literacy in the sense of everyone knows what Seinfeld is or everyone knows what Dostoevsky is, but cultural literacy in terms of saying, I understand what culture is, and what culture needs to be, and the role of culture. So I think
like
there
a
are
meta
are some,
understanding of culture.
Right, exactly. So there are some core skills, there are some core competencies, there are some core things that everyone should know. And you know, it's, you want to trust kids as long as possible to pick them up on their own, but at some point you kind of, you know, you do need to guide them towards it, if you know, if it's not working. And you know, most of the time it works. And for me, math again is much more of a spreadsheet than, you know, I don't need people to know pre-calculus. I don't know people, you know, unless you're an Apple Math or pure math person, you don't need to know binary, or you don't need to know, you know, hexadecimal, but you probably do want to know how to make a spreadsheet sing, and how to, you know, graph things and chart things and visualize things and use numbers to persuade people and all those. I think those are actually pretty core skills, and also obviously how you're being persuaded. And then colleges is, you know, remains to be just sort of this nightmare, no-win situation. There's, you know, there's like 15%, whatever, some relatively small number percentage of college experiences that are really, really important. If you're going to be an engineer, if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to be robotics, as you say, if you're going to get into hardcore AI, you know, there are some things where colleges are really, really important. Then there's a lot of other things that they're really not. And so it's, you know, again, in Unschooling Rules, I call college sort of a no-win decision. And I think that really is the case. The good news right now is that colleges are being deconstructed, because of obviously the coronavirus. And so I think school, I mean, what's sort of ironic, and I'll just back up a little bit, and then get back there, is, you know, if schools had read, I'm going to say stupidly, had read Unschooling Rules, or school, but much more importantly than that, obviously, is if schools had spent time working with the homeschooling, unschooling communities, and, you know, if they'd spent 3 or 4 years figuring out how to reach out to the homeschoolers and unschoolers and other academy people, then they would have been fully prepared for coronavirus. They would have known how to do it. And so almost, again, there's nothing more scary to me than a monoculture. There's nothing more frightening than one way of doing things, because it creates worse and worse behavior. And so just simply the monoculture of schools is interesting, of how much that came to sort of to bite them. Having said all that, again, colleges, I think, are also learning that lesson, and they're closing down, and they're having to be more flexible and having to reach out to people. And I hope we get to a point where you can take college classes more easily virtually and be on the same front, and only the ones that you want, not the ones that you don't want, and sort of, you know, put together your degree. I did a lot of interviews around cybersecurity for some of the work that I was doing. And what was interesting is I talked to, you know, literally the person in charge of cybersecurity at Intel, at Google, at Microsoft, at, you know, go through, you know, a list of, you know, big well-known companies. And over half of them did not finish college. Over half of them said, you know, I knew way more than my professor did. They were teaching me stuff that was used 10 years ago and is of absolutely no help at all. These are all the wrong things that were being taught. So even in sort of some high tech areas, you know, so again, you have sort of engineering, if you're dealing with metal, if you're dealing with equipment, if you're dealing with whatever, you need to have access to those equipment, and therefore universities are helpful. But for a lot of these other things, they're really not. The other thing to recognize increasingly is that sort of entrepreneurship is the new college degree. I think entrepreneurship is, you know, used to be, say 20 years ago, large corporations would hire people out of high school en masse. And other than, you know, you still have some of the big consulting companies, the big five consulting companies doing that with the top 1% of the students, you know, as a Deloitte or a Deloitte Intuition, whatever, KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, whatever, they're still doing that in order just to fill the seats and get billable hours. But Other than that, corporations really are not doing it anymore. The way that they're getting employees is by buying up small companies and acquiring them. And so it's that process. So, you know, the golden ticket is no longer the degree from college, but, you know, a lot of cases starting up a company and then being acquired. So, you know, the world is very different, and that allays any fears or increases fears. But, you know, at the very least, the one golden path was never the case. And it certainly is not the case at all right now.
Right. So, right. The cheese has been moved, and we need to find a new way through this maze. Right. So let's shift gears a little bit. I am so curious and excited to learn more about Short Sims.
So in this whole issue, and again, the path that I've been on is trying to figure out, again, why are schools so bad? Or, you know, why don't schools work? And one reason is the affordances of linear content. So as you say, you know.
And wait, Clark, let me just refine quickly here. You say, you know, you're saying schools in general, and do you just mean public schools, or do you also mean private schools?
Private schools, well, I mean, there's a huge variety. I'm going to say the generic stereotypical school thing, and the school thing that basically runs off books. I mean, for a lot of school programs, and I know, and I'm not talking about Acton right now at all, but I am talking about a lot of private schools, a lot of religious schools, certainly a lot of public schools. One of the realities of school is that one analogy for school perhaps is that doctors are like teachers and educational media is like the pharmaceuticals. So educational media is, if you're a lazy teacher, and I'm using that word pejoratively and unfairly, but if you are an unempowered teacher, I'll say that is a much nicer way of saying it. If you're an unempowered teacher, you're going to rely a lot on media. You're going to rely a lot on textbooks, on workbooks, on novels. Media is terrifically cheap. It's incredibly, even though textbook $60, whatever, who cares? It's not. It's still cheap. It's incredibly easy to publish a book. I mean, it's just cheap wise. It's, you know, once you have one, you can make 1,000 books of the same copy, you know, very cheaply. It's easy to distribute. George Orwell just went out of copyright. Interesting. So we've been
content driven, like content driven, basically.
Content driven and linear media driven. So the problem is it's linear media driven. The problem is that it's a very linear, it's a very linear approach, and linear media has certain affordances. It does some things well. I've tried to challenge those affordances in unschooling rules by having a bunch of standalone chapters that you can read through in any order, you're forced to explore it a little bit, and obviously not getting the easy answers, but getting the hopefully the thoughtful questions, and a bit of wind in your sails. But so that's our huge problem, is that we've built these, you know, traditional school things. When we think of, when some people think of schools, they think of writing papers. Writing papers are linear exercises. They are, you know, they're case studies typically, or they're timelines or something. And it turns out all these important skills that we're talking about, like leadership and stewardship and relationship management and innovation and creativity and security and all these important skills are not linear at all. And so, you know, how much time have scholars spent studying George Washington, random example, and how much, if you wanted to learn his project management style, could you do that? Could you practice the George Washington project management style? Presumably he was pretty good at project management. I mean, obviously he was a general and a president and did a pretty good job at both. Can we follow in his footsteps from a leadership perspective? Can we follow in his steps from an innovation perspective? Do we know how George Washington innovated? Probably not. And so, like, you know, so again, why is that if we've studied this person so exhaustively? Well, again, the reason is because of the output, the input and the output, the case studies and the novels and the linear narratives. So I've sort of been obsessed with nonlinear content and sort of how can we create simulations and how can we create interactive content that meets some of these holes. So how can we create a scalable media that's nonlinear? And so I started off in the journey in doing sort of very complicated simulations, sort of more like games with deep AI and all those important things. But over time, I kind of really came to realize that we don't need to go that deep, and that deep is actually really expensive and kind of miserable to do, but not really effective. And so I've been distilling all of that thinking into what I'm calling short sims, which is a philosophy of content. It's just a way of organizing content that is interactive, that's a bit Socratic, that is almost as, I'm thinking, again, I'm biased and I apologize, but it's almost as fundamental as writing. It's almost this cracking the door into a whole nother way of creating content that's cheap to create, that's cheap to distribute, yay. But that it gets at things in a completely different way. I'll give you one example from one of the short sims I did, which is, it costs, let's say you can earn $10 an hour. And instead of working on a Monday afternoon, you rent a 2-hour movie for $5. How much does renting that movie cost you? And I'll give you one answer. It's cost you $5. I'll give you another answer. It cost you $25. How much does it cost you? And everyone goes five, no, 25. You know, you make a jump like that. You just, you know, you go to your naive, stupid, early thing, $5, because that's how much it costs to rent the movie. And then you realize, oh, no, wait, I'm not earning $20 in time. So by doing that, you teach yourself basically an entire, chapter of Econ 101. You teach yourself the concept of opportunity cost in a way that you own it. You're like, okay, it's not a super scary thing. But so the work from a content creator is coming up with this scenario that does that opens up the door. That again, like we talked about earlier, what's the simplest way of getting someone to teach themselves that content in a predictable way? So again, going back to our teachers, our poor but miserable teachers, they have to do it predictably. So how can we create situations that are predictable for most people to teach themselves? And so that's sort of the essence of short sims. And we can do it in a much more sprawling narrative way in terms of, we can give, I just did one on COVID and for the corporate marketplace, of saying, if you're an employee and you're going through a day in the corporate workplace, in the COVID world, how do you behave? How do you behave differently? And we're going to, it's visual and you go through it. I did one on the demand curve where you're saying, okay, you run a drink truck. I'm sorry, you run a food truck that sells drinks. You can change the price. You can change the price of your drinks, and you can see the line shrink and grow as you change the price, which obviously impacts demand. The weather can change, the sun can go behind the cloud or not, which you can control. And now how do you create a situation where the demand for your drinks is exactly 7? Let's just see if you can manipulate the factors until you get that. And again, it's like a 5-minute short sim. It's something that you can play through. It's very visual, it's very graphical. And in about 5 minutes, you sort of taught yourself the basics of demand curve in terms of how it works and why it works. And it's an experiential learning thing. All these experiences, and again, if you go to shortsims.com/examples, I have a bunch of examples there to sort of, where one can play through. And so this is a whole, and there's a whole lot of little, so that's the big idea. And behind that, there's a lot of little cool tips in terms of having a coach character to walk you through, having the philosophy of not a directive leadership style. We're not telling people what to do, but as much as a collaborative leadership style of saying, hey, help me do this. Let's see if we can do this together. Another one that came out of, another short sim that came out of one of my cybersecurity interviews is, okay, you're a bad guy. You've broken into someone's bank account. They have $1,000 in the bank account. How much do you steal? And it's a very interesting question, because it gets to a very big thing. $1,000 in the bank account, how much do you steal? Most of us say, I don't know, 500, we'll steal half of it, or $1,000. It turns out what a cyber criminal does is they steal like 20 bucks, they steal like 50 bucks, but they do it every month. So every month they're going to go in there and they're going to take 50 bucks because they don't want to be caught. And so they want to take 50 bucks a month for 2 years and make a lot more money than if they just cleaned out the bank account, got caught, lost their security access and moved out. And we saw that just in the federal government here in the United States happening as well. That's what cybersecurity, cyber criminals do, is they don't want to get caught, and they'll do a lot of things so they don't get caught and cover up their own tracks. So again, we can create these little scenarios that are experiential, that people can teach themselves, and they can make common mistakes and then can learn from it. And so again, these are not high technology scenarios at all, but they're very, very low tech. I use like PowerPoint for graphics, and I use vector-based graphics, and then I sort of, it's almost like creating a little animation where you're creating sort of a bunch of sequences, and as people are making decisions, things are evolving towards it. And so in my mind, both the process of creating a short sim and the process of consuming a short sim have the ability to single-handedly change education for everyone who's not lucky enough to be in a great school. Because this stuff is, again, if you are, I'm going to use the word lazy, if you're a lazy teacher, which is horrible, if you're a downtrodden, overworked, underempowered teacher, you can still use these things. The burden is not on you as the instructor to do a tremendous amount of heavy lifting. These things are, you know, these things stand on their own. You can have group discussions. You can say, okay, everyone, run a little business. Here's a little business simulation. Let's run it for 20 minutes. Now we're going to come back when you're done and let's talk about how you did, what were the decisions you made, why you made them. And so, you know, you can, you know, and that's again easy for a teacher. But it also gets people, you know, down the path of where Acton already is in terms of, you know, sort of an active learning process that they can do it. I need to figure out how to do this. I want, you know, I'd love to see more and more students, instead of writing a term paper on a topic, create a short sim on a topic, and saying, instead of, you know, writing a term paper on George Washington, maybe I can do, let's create a George Washington project management sim. Let's have a little short sim where you are George Washington and you have a bunch of options in terms of how to accomplish something and then give feedback in terms of, you know, how you did, you know, when you did that. So again, I think we're at this cusp of rethinking how, what we can do with media by taking advantage of the interactive affordances and the cheap production that we now have access to.
Wow, fantastic. So it does, it gives students like a visceral experience of standing in the shoes of someone who has to make a difficult choice. And I think something else that you talk about, let me check my notes, is about a safe place to fail. So in a simulation, you can try again until you learn the lesson. And that's a, right? Like compared to when you're memorizing content and being tested on it, which is kind of an emotionally high stakes situation, that amygdala fires, your brain shuts down, you're not able to function. Whereas in the simulations, it's a completely different feeling where you're, it's like, go ahead and play. You're in a sandbox. You can do whatever you want. And then you are, you're like, not responsible for, but you're in charge of your own learning and that, and you will learn out of it because it's designed for that.
One step further or one step to the side of what you just said, which is when you are making a short sim, if you are doing a short sim, a huge part of the process is when you're talking to people saying, what are common mistakes that people make? You know, if you are worrying about security, what are common mistakes someone makes in the area of security? So whether you're making sure no one takes your lunchbox or making sure that your password stuff is protected or whatever, you know, what are common mistakes in security? What are common mistakes in leadership? You know, necessarily you think a lot about mistakes. If you play a computer game and you never make a mistake, it's a pretty miserable computer game. Right. It's a pretty boring experience. Part of the whatever is making, you know, lots and lots of, giving people lots and lots of failure, you know, and I want people to fail in my short sim and I want people to have fun failing. And I want people to learn from failing. And I also want people to explore. And so one of my success criteria for a good short sim is, you know, someone will play through it maybe four or five times, but in a perfect world, they get it right the third time. They play it a couple more times just sort of to screw around a little bit, just to see what happens when they try different things. I think that is the fun of learning. And that's, you know, we learn, you know, when we don't get what we thought we would get. I mean, you know, experience is what you get when you don't get what you thought you'd get. And that is, I think a lot of AI models are increasingly being focused on this thing too, which is, you know, what happens when the world doesn't align to your expectations. And I think that is the, you know, that is where learning happens. And if you're a sim designer, you know, if you are writing the textbook, you are creating the one brittle path of success, just follow these rules and you'll be fine. And that of course is absurd. And if you're a sim designer, if you're a short sim designer, you're thinking a lot about failure, and failure is not this, you know, you fail and okay, on to plan B. It's not this moral failing or this existential failing. It's just, well, of course, because you didn't know, now you do know, keep going. So I think Acton has such a healthy perspective on failure as something that if you're not failing, you're not, you know, you're not doing it. And I sort of think of frustration itself as the sweat of learning. You know, if you're not frustrated, if you're not failing, then you're not learning anything. And again, we know that in computer games intuitively, and we need to obviously incorporate that into all learning.
Very well said. So do you have any sims, short sims that are collaborative, or is it all individual student?
It's a very, very disciplined process. It's always one-on-one. It's always one to computer, which makes it very scalable. Where I have built plenty of short sims that are for communities, and typically it's go off and play the short sim and then come back and we'll talk about it. We'll talk about your strategies or something. Oh. So it can be used, you know, so it's a single player prop, but it can be used in the context of community discussions very easily. And certainly has been in plenty of, Harvard does some, Visa, the credit card company does some short sims. They all use them from, you know, to start and level set on collaborative conversations.
Are you familiar with Synthesis School that came out of Ad Astra?
I'm aware of them, but not intelligently.
Okay. My kids have just signed up to Synthesis, and they're playing it. It's very interesting. It's collaborative game playing, and they keep creating new games that they keep moving up through, and it's fascinating. My children won't let me in the room when they're doing it, so I haven't really seen it, but they're having a great time. And I also think gaming, for example, Minecraft, right? Like in Minecraft, my kids play it and they are learning so much. I mean, it's like limited resources. You have to go around and mine for them. You can, you know, create small businesses. You can have a business where you sell wool, and then you have to raise the sheep and you have to make sure that the sheep are fed. I mean, it's very, very complex. There's a lot of different trade-offs. There's a lot of hard work. There's timing, there's weather. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in there that I think parents may underestimate how powerful Minecraft is for learning the metagame, and also for learning, you know, so many things about life and even entrepreneurship.
There are some epic games. There are some absolutely spectacularly good games. Civilization is sort of a classic example, obviously. But not as good as Minecraft. But I think the problem with their successes is they've created almost an expectation or a desire to sort of create educational versions of those. And those have almost all those efforts have failed spectacularly. And so my own personal passion of the last 5 or 6 years is almost untangling myself from that thinking of saying, we're not going to create a AAA game in the educational space to cover all these topics. If there's a great game like Minecraft, by all means, use it and absorb it. If there's a great game like Civilization, if there's a great game like Theme Hospital, whatever, use it and embrace it and then sort of work it into the curriculum. But we're not going to have students building a Minecraft. They can build a little game within Minecraft, as you say. But if we're going to get students building content, if we're going to get teachers and instructors and guides building content, if we're going to even get the National Science Foundation building content, the goal is not, or the Gates Foundation building content, the goal should not be, in my opinion anymore, should not be, you know, a computer game like activity, because I don't believe that structure is in place. And so the short sim philosophy has come as a reaction to that, of saying, well, what can we create? How can we use media as judiciously as possible? How can we get away from requiring the exotic skills that VR or AR or AAA computer games require today? We don't necessarily, you know, we're not going to have someone who's a great programmer in Unity or whatever. What can we do instead of that? Because I think that's a trap. And I think that almost the last 10 years or 20 years now, sort of computer games as a model of education beyond a couple of great games that work very well, has led to a lot of failures. And so I've overseen a lot of corpses of projects that had those very good intentions in mind, but I do not believe systemically those are going to be capable of being produced within the next decade. So I think it's going to be a different approach. The other thing is through the democratization of content creation and interactive content creation and ownership of the experience, which I'm a huge fan of, I think we need to have the thousand flowers blooming, not to misquote Mao, but you know, we do need to say how can we have as many experiments going as we can, and then let people learn from each other. And so, you know, in my scenario right now, the great game of 10 years from now, the great educational experience game-like experience is going to be born from maybe someone in your class or maybe a friend of mine building a little short sim, and then someone next year saying, oh, I can add to that, and then I can add to that, and let's almost like pearls, let's grow, let's create a lot of little prototypes and then see which one, the good ones will live on their own and then be expanded upon over time, rather than saying, hey, let's create the giant computer game about project management or something, which is going to be, you know, the chance of it failing is quite high.
I hear you. It seems to me your sims, your short sims, I've done a couple of them on your site. It feels like a good conversation with an adult or someone, a mentor, let's say. I feel like I've had conversations like that with mentors when I, you know, worked in companies and things like that, who would kind of lead me through stuff Socratically or let me go try something. And then I would have to come back with the project and they would say, you know, okay, this is great, but what about this? What about this? What about this? And those were such seminal moments of learning for me. And I guess, you know, not everyone gets to have those opportunities, or, you know, you certainly can't predict when they're coming. So it sounds like you've created something that provides that to anyone who comes in and wants to do a sim. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And there's a lot there, but the notion of a coach character, the notion of someone who's there to help you, is a really, really important one. And again, a lot of linear content can't do that because it's just, you know, again, we've all written books, we've all written papers, and, you know, hey, I'm the boss and I'm telling you what to read next and what to read next and what to read next. And, you know, it's awful. I hate writing because it's so directive. I want to give you the chance of playing with it. And then the creation of the coach characters is really important because you do want to have someone who's there on your side, who's not, you know, the language is, you know, how can I help you? Again, the analogy I always think of is Jeeves, you know, from the Bertie and Jeeves Wister, or Jarvis from the Iron Man Marvel movies, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, that's the way we want to learn. We want to be the mad scientist, and we want to have the Jarvis or the Jeeves cleaning up after us. And, you know, that's how most of us want to learn. And so, you know, how can we create that situation where we have a very helpful slave who's there to both guide us and also to tolerate our mistakes and to clean up our messes and to, you know, I love the moment in sort of the Bertie Wister Jeeves, you know, things where Bertie says, I'm going to do this. And, you know, Jeeves goes, you know, very good, sir. You know, which is it's the stupidest idea I've ever heard, but I can't really say that because I'm subservient, but I'm going to, you know, okay, you know, good luck. And I'm here to clean up your messes. And, you know, and what a great way that is to learn. And we saw that in sort of the Iron Man, you know, again, the first Iron Man movie as well, when he's building a suit of armor and he has the Jeeves or the Jarvis who's going to be cleaning up after him and help him with his messes, but also, you know, there to allow him to be mad scientist. And I think that's, you know, as much as we can at least hint at that, at least we can create content that gets a little bit of that feeling, then I think we're doing pretty well.
So would you talk more? Our audience is really parents and also educators who do feel a sense of frustration or that their cheese has moved in the conventional system. And they're on that precipice of what do I do now? And they really are looking at options. So on this podcast, we talk to all kinds of different people that are doing all kinds of different new things so that we can get kind of a vista of everything. And people can kind of pick and choose what they want. And some still kind of have questions in their minds, like, how does this all work? So can you talk a little bit more about how conventional school is or isn't preparing kids for what's coming and why it's so important that we start to look at alternatives? Not just, you know, COVID has forced a lot of people to look at alternatives, but even post-COVID, like what are the motivators there for doing that?
Ask that question a little bit differently. I want to make sure I'm answering your question.
Sure. I think that families are still so afraid to jump out of the conventional system. They still see it as like, if the conventional system isn't working for my child, maybe I'll choose a different option. So they see it as a B option instead of seeing it as the better option, like the innovated option.
There's so many ways into this conversation. I mean, there's parents with kids who are doing well. There's parents with kids who aren't doing well. There's total outliers. you know, there's some kids who should be in traditional schools, but that's not many. And there's, you know, there's some kids who are thriving, and that's great, and power to them. I think it's, I mean, the limitations of school are tremendous. And I think that is something that we have sort of, you know, come to terms with. And one, just one example that I had a friend, who was a very physical person, who was just an incredibly just liked doing things. And, was having a terrible time in school, and he eventually was kicked out of high school. And his teachers hated him and said he was like the worst student ever. And he went and joined the military and found a home there. And he's now an incredibly accomplished Ranger. And he's, you know, he's people saying he's going to be a general. And you know, and that's a very not unusual story. I mean, not saying military is great or not great or whatever, but just saying is we all have different, you know, we all have different skill sets. We all have different pools of talent. And, you know, to expect one way to, I mean, probably 40% of the people in schools, especially, you know, probably more males than females, are very kinesthetic people. They're kinesthetic learners. They are not wired for school, and school is literally speaking a foreign language for them. And they're, you know, they're in a lot of trouble. I mean, they're in a lot of trouble if they're, you know, they're going to be almost inevitably in a school system, you know, the bottom half, and they're going to be the C-minus kids or something, and they're going to be acting up and stuff. And, you know, it's, and so again, the number of people for whom school is just simply a foreign language. And again, we sort of associate a morality with doing well in school, which is fairly repugnant. You know, for me, this, you know, it might as well be juggling. You know, we might as well be having, you know, we might as well be lining up people around who's the best jugglers, and we're going to promote the best jugglers. And, you know, it's just, it's a fairly random skill that, you know, that there's a core school skill, which is, you know, a way of learning, which is not the way the real world works. And a kind of content that's consumed and a kind of content that's produced. And it all has nothing to do with the world. It doesn't prepare people. And oftentimes the best, you know, students are not, I mean, almost inevitably the best students are not the best, most successful people, you know, in terms of the profession. So, you know, again, your question is a very good one in terms of saying, is there safety in school? Should we look at the traditional school system as being safe? And I think for most people, it's almost the opposite. For most people, it's a fundamentally unsafe. It's going to absolutely hurt them. I think the other part of it is, you know, how much can you protect kids from school? How much can you, you know, do things along their interests and not sort of accept the biases of schools, the affordances of schools, which they will always lean into? And how do you explore topics? And so, again, going back to sort of one of the first things I said, you know, the goal of education is to find out what you're really good at, find out what you care a lot about, and then figure out how to connect the two. That's the goal of education. And so, you know, almost regardless of the system that you're in, you as a parent need to be spending your time doing that. How can I help develop? How can I understand my kids' passions? How can I understand their skill sets? And then how can I, you know, give them internships or give them, you know, experience? By the way, one great way, to, you know, for anyone over 12 or 13 years old to figure out what their passion is of whom are they envious? It's one of the great drivers. It's like everyone's, you know, like, I'm so jealous or I'm so envious. I'm so envious of this person. And I think that's a great way of saying, okay, that's where your natural inclinations are, because, you know, you're not envious of people who are completely outside of your skill sets. So you're only envious of those people whom you almost feel like is achievable. So it's a great technique. And so
it's a great, you know, question.
It's a really fun one. Because again, we think of it as such a bad thing. In fact, it's such a North Star, such a compass. So, you know, and then you start looking at schools as sort of saying, not, oh, I need to follow the rules of the school, but saying, you know, are the schools helping me do this? And if not, are there other schools available to me that could better help me do this? I think if you have that as your goal, you can now start. And by the way, some people have no good options there. Some people have, you know, two or three bad options in terms of helping them do that, in which case they have to do a lot of the heavy lifting of saying, you know, am I going to spend my goodwill as a parent making them do their homework, or am I going to spend my goodwill, you know, going on a field trip to the local Lockheed Martin, you know, development center, or, you know, or getting them an internship at the NSA or whatever, depending on the skill set. So I think you have to start off with this, with each individual person. And obviously we're all individuals, and then look at your options in terms of how can you know, who's the best group out there to help this, help your youngster meet that challenge.
Thank you so much for that. So you went to Brown, right? So you went to an Ivy League school. You've achieved amazing educational goals. And so a question I'd like to ask is, knowing what you know about how we are, how the world is right now, and how expensive college is and things like that, if you were, you, Clark Aldrich, were a senior in high school right now, post-COVID, and you could either go to college or you could take that money and do something else with it, what would you choose?
I'll say it this way. I mean, I've not gone to get my PhD in education, which plenty of people said that I could have or should have or might have or something. I spent, you know, the last 20 years, I've role modeled a way of learning that I think is very compatible with me. I hate schools and I hate the way schools work. And I'm not motivated by schools and I'm not motivated by making my teacher give me an A rather than I don't care if I get an A or a C. I just truly do not care. I'm really, really happy if a client is happy with the project. I'm really, really, I will kill myself to make a client happy. I could care less if the TA that's grading my paper likes my paper or not. So, you know, even the motivation system of schools don't work with me. I hate every second of it. I hate linear content passionately. I hate the contrivances of it. I hate the affordances of it. So the last 20 years of my life, I have been following a model of learning that I believe in, which is learning by doing and exploring and finding companies that are, you know, fellow travelers, even for a short period of time. And so, you know, I've worked with ETS, who does the SATs. I've worked with Harvard. I've worked with a bunch of, you know, again, very large corporations, IBM, whatever, Cisco, Microsoft. And, you know, and you find fellow travelers and you journey with them. I always had my goal of trying to figure out how to make education work. They had their goal of, you know, making money and helping their employees become more aware of things or whatever. And, you know, we crossed our paths for a while and we both benefited, hopefully. And then we moved on to other relationships. And I think that's a really, really good model for me of, you know, that's going to bring out my best. That's going to allow me to construct the life that I want to for myself. You know, I don't think, I mean, I was not ready for that, you know, at graduating from prep school. I was not ready to think in those terms, and perhaps being the result. I mean, I was a very good student, which did not make me a very good person or a very superior person anyway at all. Just simply, you know, I could do it well, even though I hated every minute of it. And so, you know, but I was not ready to do the journey that I eventually was on. It took me 10 years out of college to start being proactive and starting to control, you know, starting to be a lot more, have a lot more agency in what I was doing other than what paid well and what seemed interesting. So it's not the answer, perhaps that it didn't really quite answer your question, but I think it got there indirectly anyway.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're saying. Okay. So you made a great analogy earlier, and I'm going to invite you to extend it a little bit more. What would be, if you were to offer a metaphor for conventional school compared to your short sims, what would that be?
I mean, I think conventional, I mean, the analogy I start off on schooling rules with, I think is still a good one, which is conventional schools are like eating out of the frozen food section of a supermarket. And all the time. I mean, just an endless stream of that. And, you know, it's like really, really good for the first... It's really, really good for the first four bites. And then pretty soon you're getting really, really sick of it. And then you're sort of realizing that it's all the same stuff in different forms and it's not nutritionally valuable. And so I'm hoping short sims is a different kind of food. I'm not going to quite say it's the organic pear I can't go that far, but it gets you away from the frozen food into a different section, to a different relationship with food, not, you know, the more active one. So, you know, perhaps the peas you have to shell and eat or something, or maybe the seeds to grow, maybe a microcraft beer or something, but it's a, you know, it's a more active process. It's less consumption oriented. It's more, yeah, perhaps, you know, a way of growing your own food. It's a more active process, but it's doing it with a friend. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a really important thing, as you said, with the short sims, it's, you know, we don't want to do stuff alone. I mean, it's fun to be lost with a friend. It's miserable to be lost by yourself. And so, you know, I want to create situations where at least you're kind of lost with a friend. And then you figure it out and you feel great about it and you've learned something. I don't learn a geography unless I get lost there, by the way. So if I'm traveling around the world, you know, Palo Alto or Austin or whatever, I don't know the area until I'm lost and I'm late for a meeting. And that's when I really get to learn it well. And so, you know, obviously when you're alone and doing that, it's pretty miserable, but it's when you're with a friend, it's a pretty great experience. And so I guess it's sort of that. I've now mixed four or five metaphors. I apologize.
That's okay. Okay, great. Yes. And that's actually when you need to know the geography is when you're using it. Right. So that we're back to learn to learn. So fantastic. So tell the audience, please, where can they experience these short sims for themselves?
Again, go to shortsims.com/examples.
Okay.
And then there's a tool called Twine, which is a free open source tool that I would recommend for people building their own and start thinking about, you know, can we start building, you know, for teachers in schools, can we start building our own short sims? Let's, you know, look at all the ones that I've made the ones that are on the site as role models, as examples, and then start creating your own. And I think we, you know, the more people who are creating their own short sims, I think you're going to create great content for your students or your kids and starting to get the kids building short sims themselves. I think it's a revolution in the way in our relationship with media, both as consumers and creators, that I think is a really helpful, interesting new perspective. And certainly you will look at all content differently and much more as active rather than passive, through an active rather than passive lens, which is really exciting.
Fantastic. And what age range would you say that short sims are ideal for?
As a creator or as a consumer?
Both.
As a consumer, infinitely young. I mean, there's no limit there.
5 years old?
5, 6 years old, 10 years, 7 years old. You know, I mean, you know, and you can do. You don't even need to read if you construct it the right way. It's just, you know, it's a relationship with content. From a creation perspective, I'm going to probably say a 10-year-old is probably the right age to start building short sims and just starting to think about content in a more active way.
Fantastic. Well, when I was researching all of this, I found the short sims and I sent them to all the Acton Network. And many people have written back and said that it was fantastic for launches to engage students in them. So I'm sure you'll be getting a lot of hits from Acton folks.
That's great. But again, make your own. And that's, you know, use like with Unschooling Rules, it's a place to start. It's not a place to end. These are not all the answers. This is hopefully an empowering tool where you can start building them yourself. Do better than me. I mean, please, you know, leave me in the dust. make much better stuff than I do. And share it and spread it and build on each other's. You know, everyone needs to stand on the shoulders of giants that came before us. Learn from each other and then just start. And that's, you know, it's an incredibly interesting way of changing ourselves and also changing the world.
Truly. And is there a place where you're collecting these when other people make short sims? Is there kind of a library of them that people can choose from?
I have to do that. There's a forum on Facebook where we're talking about this stuff in a regular basis, but I will have to. Thanks. One more to do. Thank you. Appreciate that. I will have to create a good library. And I do have a lot of them that are aimed at high school students. So it's a good thing to do.
Fantastic. Well, Clark Aldrich, this has been a fantastic conversation. We've learned so much. I'm sure the audience really appreciates everything that you have said and will be rushing off to check out Short Sims. Is that the best place to go to learn more about what you're doing, or is there a more direct URL that you would like to share with the audience?
No, that's the place. That's the place to go and think about it and experience it yourself. And again, I hate me talking about this stuff. I want people to dive in and then play it themselves and start building it themselves. I think that's the right order.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on our podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the New Schools Podcast. Tell a friend. Previous episodes and show notes, including any books or websites our guests recommend, can be found at thenewschools.com. If you're a parent who is looking for a new school for your family, send us a message. We would love to help. We can answer questions, share the resources we have, and help you get in touch with people in your area who are on the same path, determined to provide their kids with the best education. It's wildly important work. Thank you for doing it, and we'll see you next time.